enforce that? Is somebody going to be traveling out to the villages on a continual basis? I mean, I can't even get to all my villages. How are you going to do that?
We don't know all the answers yet. This is a big task. We will have to travel to many of those for an annual inspection. I'm not sure that there may be a way to get EPA to agree that we wouldn't have to inspect all of them since they're so numerous. And we are also thinking of working with cooperative agencies such as the Alaska Power Energy Authority, because they have a handle on who is in what location, what facilities they have. We can work with larger organizations to get some of these objectives solved, as well as work through those organizations to get this information to the village co-op so they understand what this is about and can input into the process, as well as help develop the program that will best meet their needs.
One final question. Then, have you already started that process of contacting the village co-ops and letting them know that this Clean Air Act is going to impact the villages?
We have had a presentation meeting with that was sponsored by Alaska Energy Authority about 6 to 8 weeks ago that brought in several of those village co-ops, some of the larger groups. We have to expand that in the very near future here, and we will be doing that. But we have broken the ice and started that, as well as with some other organizations.
Thank you. Representative Moyer.
Well, first, I'll follow up on that point. We are still looking 2 years down the road before some of these permits are actually going to be written.
Absolutely, yes.
We have a fairly good lead time to work with.
Right. This permit program is required to be official in fall of 1993. It'll be 1995 or thereabouts before we are actually issuing a large percent of these permits.
No, actually, that was just off the top of the head thought. Tom mentioned that. The reason I raised my hand then was to, on your earlier question, you were asking about meeting new standards in the villages, and maybe a distinction needs to be made between standards and permits, that in many cases, a permit, a piece of paper, might be all a village needs, and maybe do nothing different than they've been doing beforehand.
That is correct. We don't at this time see any significant changes in what the diesel facilities will have to comply with as far as out-of-stack standards. And we don't see a need to for most cases. We're more concerned about new installations than existing installations. Diesel engines themselves are relatively, the impact is relatively minor for most locations, unless there is a large bank of diesels in a confined area.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on that, another option out there to avoid even the need for permitting in some of these villages is one of the technologies that the AEA has been examining, the use of battery systems. Some of the tests they're doing indicate they can reduce the amount generators have to run in villages down to a quarter of what time they run now by use of some of the battery systems. That would get a lot of these village generating systems below the threshold even to get a permit, I would suspect. And they actually have been found to extend the life of the generators up to 3 or 4 times because they aren't running all the time. So I think there may be a whole lot of different answers to the question.
Representative Carney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked in terms of a time frame for us to implement this act. What is the time frame if we fail to implement it for the feds to implement?
Representative Carney, we are obligated to submit a plan to EPA in fall of 1993. Basically, if we fail to meet that date, we have a grace period of 18 months to 2 years before they must do an action, and that action would be start to implement a program themselves, as well as to start processing or beginning the steps to sanction federal highway dollars and air pollution grant dollars.
Further questions?
Thank you.
I'll try to quickly complete this overhead because the lower part doesn't change a lot. Refineries would still need permits at about the same level. The PSD, you'll see this acronym again, is to prevent significant deterioration. That generally reflects facilities that are emit 250 tons per year or more of a pollutant, and that stays the same. The one thing is new and is quite important to us is that facilities that emit hazardous air pollutants at a level of 25 tons per year of one or more hazardous air pollutants, or 10 tons per year of a single hazardous air pollutant, we need a permit. With the hazardous, there's a lot of material to talk about with the hazardous air pollutant program, but there's basically, the federal government is on a schedule to establish standards, basically emission standards for certain groups of facilities that emit hazardous air pollutants over a set period of time. We then, assuming that we were to have a state permitting program to meet this requirement, would be implementing those standards in the permits that are issued. I would like to move on to just touch base with what we feel are both the required and essential components of the statutory law that we would need to implement the permit program and comply with the Clean Air Act. At the top of the list are the required essentials, and when I say required, I mean that these are the absolute minimums we would need an authority to receive federal approval for our permit program. It by no means limits us to or contains all the things we would need to make this the best workable type of program for our industries and our people. First of all, the exclusive fund for air permit program. Basically, we're required under the Act to establish permit fees, and those fees, as I mentioned before, have to be adequate to sustain the permitting function. And those fees, monies that are collected, can only be used for the permitting function. That also means they cannot be used for helping us solve our transportation control problems, such as exist in Anchorage and Fairbanks, where the motor vehicles are the principal source of pollution. Those funds cannot be used for that activity. Second of all, we need to create a small business assistance program. The components of that are, one is to create an advisory panel that basically is an oversight panel to guide the assistance program, as well as to report to the federal small business assistance program on the efficiency and performance of the state program. We also feel it's important to expand the small business program to as many businesses as we can under the Clean Air Act. We feel this is one of the significant benefits, it's the good sides of what's in the Act, amongst all the onerous requirements of the Act. So if we can expand it as much as possible to help our small businesses out, it's desirable. We need to modify our criminal provisions and fines. These are relatively minor changes. The fines would go from a minimum currently of $5,000 to a $10,000, not minimum fine, excuse me, it's a $5,000 per day maximum fine. In current statutory law, we need to change it to $10,000. Certain actions regarding permits and monitoring systems would become criminal violations. We feel it's important to have a separate construction permit from an operating permit. The reason here is the new Act requires basically an operating permit, and other provisions require construction permits. The time to issue a permit is going to increase under the new Clean Air Act in comparison to what we do now. The operating permit, after the state gets to the point of conducting a comment period and developing a draft permit, there is basically another 2 months involved for EPA to look at that and object to it before we can issue a final operating permit. If we take the avenue of separating construction permits, and construction permits would only be required for a subset of all sources, we could issue those construction permits in the same time period we do now. And while the facility is being built, then the operating permit would be carried out and issued in about 2 months downstream. This also, agency operator emission limits talks about legal agreements to contain emissions below the permit level, so a permit's not required. We think that's an important feature. General permits is an item that is another provision of the Act that we feel can be very useful to us. Basically, a general permit is a system whereby the state would develop basically a uniform permit, a boilerplate type of permit that would apply to a given facility, such as a diesel generating plant with fuel storage capacity of a certain size. We could establish a number of general permits where we would develop the permit, take it to comment, get EPA's points and objections on it, and then when a specific facility wanted that permit, if they met the requirements, that permit could be issued in 30 days after an application is filed, a much faster process. So we'll be looking towards trying to group our facilities and decide which one it is efficient to have general permits for. We feel it's important to have flexibility for a permit fee structure. We are conscious of the burden, financial burden, this might place on small businesses with the permit fees. We also feel it's appropriate to look at a number of avenues to how to structure these fees. We have latitude in the Clean Air Act to establish a state fee program. It's not a mandatory $25 per ton as the lead-in or guidance is provided. We have flexibility to change that. We need to have the ability to implement new rules, new federal rules in permits, and that basically means if new federal rules are adopted, we need to reopen certain permits that are out there to place those rules in the permit. We also need to have emission limits, or the ability to set emission limits, that are based on either the risk to public health or the availability of economically viable technology, such as might be the case where a source would have a large amount of pollution, but that pollution is very well dispersed before it hits the ground level, so it doesn't cause a violation of the health standard. Yet to put a control device on there would be relatively cheap or economical from the technology point of view, and it would reduce the emissions to the air and improve air quality at an economical rate. We want local governments to be a partner in this program. We want the flexibility for local governments to join us and share this program, provided they want to participate. There is a desire and a better way. Many local governments can serve their industries and their businesses better than the state can. And we don't want to preclude that from occurring. The current statutory law needs some changes if we're going to do that with the new Clean Air Act. We're also proposing that we have administrative penalties in this new statutory law. There's really two reasons for that. Currently, violations are often not pursued because it takes more in court costs and attorney fees than the resulting penalties would occur. Also, we need to have a relatively strong enforcement program if we are to stay in the lead with our program and not have EPA intervening. Their enforcement powers are tremendously increased. If ours are not increased somewhat, it'll be a half-open door for them to overfile on enforcement cases and thus take us out of the position of being the lead with our industries and permittees.
I have a question for you, Tom, on violators. Is there an approach for people whose air rights, if we can speak in those terms, are being violated if there are people whose air rights are being violated by polluters, is there an avenue to pursue litigation if, in fact, we do not have an avenue through administrative penalties?
They have an avenue in the permit review process that if they can participate when the permit is drafted. If they don't feel their rights are being correctly addressed, they can take that to adjudicatory review under current regulations and followed by judicial review.
And this represents an expeditious addressing of the problems?
Compared to
regular types of litigation.
The administrative penalties, yes, because we feel that if we use the administrative penalties process and the violator feels it was an unfair action on the department, they can always take it to judicial review and take it to court to settle to see if the judge wants to make a determination on that.
Well, I guess the one thing I was getting at is frequently people's rights or they become victims of some of these pollutions. And of course, government always takes the bad rap that we're trying to impose unfavorable or impossible regulations. Sometimes that's, I think, true, in fact. But I was wondering how we could expedite a person who is being damaged by some of this pollution, give them the right to some kind of expeditious judicial avenue to address the wrongs that are being done to them.
To address your question, Mr. Chairman, there's one provision of this act that says that when a permit is issued, that permit document contains all the requirements that the permittee must meet to comply with the act, and it's pretty much a sealed document at that point. However, in the development of that permit, there are many steps for an aggrieved party, if not with the state, with the Environmental Protection Agency. If the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't listen to them at first, they can file a petition with the EPA. So there is actually, in total, about 7 to almost 9 months that an aggrieved party can fight a permit.
Thank you.
Just to conclude this rapidly here, the last part is the public involvement in permits. As listed here, there are a number of steps. This act provides many more opportunities for interested parties to be involved in the process as well as object to the findings. And one point to keep in mind is that every permit that we draft, the Environmental Protection Agency has 45 days to object to that, and they basically have a veto power to say that we cannot issue that permit. If we were to issue that permit anyway, they have step-in rights, so to speak. And that concludes the general presentation. I'm certainly be open to any more questions.
Are there questions by members of the committee of the officials from DEC? No questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chappell. Are there other things, Mr. Borelli, that you wish to address at this time?
Yes, if we have time, I'd like to get
please. How much time do you need, sir?
Depends on the questions, probably another 10 minutes.
Okay, please can proceed.
One of the pretty charts we developed for this, just to throw it up for you, is the hazardous air pollutants. And it's really complicated. There's 189 pollutants here, and they're spread out on the ground. And the act takes place, the various standards and MACT and things that go on. It's really
this list.
Yes. So I just wanted to throw that up there because we put a lot of work in it, but it's part of the act that it's really not going to take a lot of our time to do. The Title V is basically the time consumer in this one. I want to touch a little bit about the mobile sources because folks from Anchorage obviously are affected by that. And what we're in the process of doing now is developing a new air quality plan. And what does that mean to folks who live in Anchorage and whatnot now? They're used to the inspection and maintenance program, and yet we're still not in attainment at this point. So we're going to have to revisit what was done and begin to enter a new process in which we try to resolve that situation. You've probably heard of oxygenated fuels. That's part of the program. We look at that as an interim step to the cold temperature standards in which Congress had passed. They're presently in EPA rulemaking now, and we're hoping they'll be out soon. What this actually means is that cars will be tested by the Environmental Protection Agency. The new cars that will be manufactured will be able to pass tests down to 20 degrees. Right now it's 68 to 86 degrees, so they'll be required to test down to 20 degrees, and we feel that, you know, go a significant way towards resolving the problem, and that at that time frame we'll be able to take oxygenated fuels out of the marketplace. There's technology associated with the new cars that would be in the cold temperature would basically able to read the oxygen anyway and compensate. So that's our strategy for the future. Commuters are another problem for the valley folks that we're looking at right now. There is an impact on the valley traffic. We figure there's about 6,000 commuters, and that used to be what we considered an insignificant amount in the early modeling, but now that we're starting to tweak down on it, it may be, you know, possible to have to bring the commuters into this, and we have already, you know, looked into that, and we'll be continuing to look into that. The other thing that's going to come to your attention from other folks is the diesel vehicle low sulfur fuel standards. The present situation in Alaska is we do not have the refinery capacity to produce this low sulfur fuel. We're in the process of trying to negotiate with EPA and develop a plan to go forward to see if we can search out at least a short-term exemption consistent with the Canadian government's implementation of a low sulfur fuel program. And for the rural areas, and the rural we're going to be defining as not attached to a road or the marine highway, we may get a 10-year exemption with a reopener to see if low sulfur fuel is indeed the fuel of choice by then. And then we have general planning provisions to demonstrate attainment, contingency measures, and emission inventories that we have to get done over the next few months. Smith? That about concludes it. If there's any other questions.
Are there additional questions of Mr. Borelli, Representative Lehman?
I just wanted to quickly pursue this oxygenated fuels. I understand that in the two non-attainment areas in the state, not with Fairbanks and Anchorage, if we remain non-attainment, we're required, and I assume then if the cold temperature standards don't work, we will be required to use oxygenated fuels.
Well, at that point, it's going to be it's going to take a lot of thought on that, because the vehicles, by that time, we expect to be so refined, computerized, that maybe the oxygen won't do anything for us. It's more targeted at the low end. See, right now, our vehicle mix is such that there is a significant benefit, but as the cars get into the 80s, newer and newer, the computer systems are more sophisticated, the oxygenates are less effective. So it may just die of its own volition just because of the car technology. And we have to look to other curtailment measures if the cold start vehicles did not resolve the problem.
Additional questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for a fine overview on the most difficult and complex topic. And we certainly appreciate it. Look forward to working with you in the near future to resolve clean air problems of Alaska. And in that regard, House Bill 377 will have a working subcommittee, and on that committee, I would like to appoint Representative Moyer as chairman, Representative Finkelstein, Representative Lehman, and Representative Lincoln. Thank you. And with that, I would like to adjourn this meeting of the House Resources at 5:06 p.m.